This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Gung Ho by Ken Blanchard and Sheldon Bowles. Read for you by Agnes Herman.
Gung Ho. Tuesday, I made my promise to Andy Longclaw. I promised to tell you how we saved our business from closure, how we then made record profits with record productivity, how you too can motivate and turn on the power of your whole workforce. But first, I want to tell you why I made this promise and how this book came to be written. It all began at Walton Memorial Hospital, June 7, 1994. Andy was in the hospital. We both knew it would be our last visit, but I couldn't bring myself to admit he was going, or to tell him the things I needed to say. Instead, I chatted brightly about the spring day, baseball, and business. In mid-sentence, I stopped. I'd just run out of small talk. There was, for me, a short and awkward silence. Then I heard my thoughts break through. "I love you, Andy," I choked out. His large, weathered hand moved slowly across the sheet and covered mine with a grip that was still surprisingly strong. "I know," he said, then added, "I love you too. Always have." Whether it was the emotion of the moment or my visit that had worn him out, I don't know. But he closed his eyes. His head rested easily on the pillow. I knew he wasn't asleep. His hand still held mine in a reassuring grip. He may simply have been honoring the moment with silence. I had learned over the years that a long silence from Andy was his way of telling me that what I'd said was important. It deserved its own space before being banished by a reply. We sat together, our hands touching, for several minutes. Andy once told me his mother had taught him not to wait for silence before speaking, but rather to wait for the silence to end. Finally, Andy spoke, his voice clear but weak. "I will be leaving today to join my ancestors." As always, he tackled the issue head on. I didn't reply, but no reply was necessary as he continued. "You have blessed me with pride and riches." "Oh, no, Andy, no," I protested. "It is you who have blessed me and everyone in the company." "We have done much together," Andy said with a wisdom and finality. Then he added, "There is still much to be done. Too many toil alone. They are unhappy. Their spirits die at the office door." I gave Andy's hand a gentle squeeze. "Their spirits die at the office door." How true. All across America, spirits died at the office door. "You must tell the story so our children can tell their children." Andy paused and took several deep breaths before continuing. "The Gung Ho story. The spirit of the squirrel. The way of the beaver. The gift of the goose." "I will, Andy. I will. I promise."
"Thank you," he replied. "You have lifted my last burden."
Then he added,
"The owl calls my name and waits to lead me on. I will go while there is still light."
He looked over at me and smiled with a look of tranquility I'll never forget.
"Gung ho, friend."
"Gung ho, friend," I replied. Gung ho had been our special greeting and our goodbye for many years. This was to be our last. What follows is the story I promised to tell. I'd been set up. Me, Peggy Sinclair, head office rising star. I should have realized it when old man Morris told me I'd been named general manager of Walton Works No. 2. The excitement of getting my own plant blinded me to what must have been obvious to everyone else.
I'd never been in operations before, always in a staff position. I knew the theory all right, but I'd never done it. I wasn't trained or ready to run a plant, even one doing well. And this one wasn't. I thought I'd been forgiven for the staff study I'd authored, which concluded that Old Man Morris's new strategic plan had a fatal flaw. He wasn't happy. But he acknowledged the problem, and this saved the company $1 million. I thought Walton Works number 2 was my reward. It was, just not the way I had it figured. Tuesday, September 4th, 8 a.m. I arrived at the Walton Works number 2 plant full of energy and enthusiasm. By quitting time, it was clear that I'd been had. Everyone knew the plant was the worst in the system. But I had never imagined anything this bad. 6 months, a year at the most, and it would be closing. Gone, and I'd be going with it. The perfect scapegoat for Walton Works number 2. It didn't take a genius to see why productivity was so low. The company treated the raw material piled in the yard better than it treated the workers. As I met with my management team, I found only one bright spot. The 150-person finishing department. In spite of the problems with Walton Works number 2, no other department in our whole 32-plant system was so efficient. That meant about 10% of this plant's workforce were gems. The rest appeared to be lumps of coal managed by Neanderthals intent on self-destruction. Then, when I met with the division manager to whom the manager of the finishing department reported, I was told all wasn't well, even there. "You'll want to get rid of the operations manager there fast," the division manager advised. "Andy Longclaw is bad news. Indian guy, you know. Now, I've nothing against Indians, and this one's a bright brave. Got an MBA, even. But he's a troublemaker. Real thorn in the side. That department will be even better once he's gone. Indians," he added with evident distaste. I didn't know if Andy Longclaw was a troublemaker or not, but I did know this division manager wasn't going to last while I was around. I might be fired myself in 6 months, but I didn't have to spend it in the presence of narrow-minded fools like him. At day's end, the office emptied out so quickly you'd have sworn the fire alarm had gone off. There was still plenty of daylight left, so I decided to take a long walk. I started down Main Street. I didn't have a destination. I was just wandering and thinking. I noted the town had 2 supermarkets, 2 drugstores, and a statue in front of the town library. Reading the inscription, I discovered that unlike most towns, the statue didn't honor a famous warrior or long-dead politician, but instead an artist. Apparently, Walton had been home to Andrew Peyton, a Native American woodcarver, who had won a number of international awards for his beautiful wildlife carvings. I crossed the bridge. A green field led to the river edge, and a lone bench sat looking across the river to where the factory stood looking grim and lifeless. A good metaphor, I decided, for what was happening inside. As I neared the bench, a tall, dark-haired man ambling along from the other direction flopped down, hands thrust deep in his pockets. He'd taken the far end of the bench. Normally, I'd have been wary sitting next to a stranger, but I felt the safety of a small town. "Mind if I sit down?" I asked.
"Sure thing, but I'm afraid I'm not very good company today."
"Troubles?" I asked, more from politeness than caring.
"Expect I'm going to be fired,"
the man answered with that charming frankness that can exist between total strangers. "How come?" I ventured.
"I work at the plant over there. Have for the past 15 years. Tomorrow, though, who knows?"
I looked at my benchmate with new interest. I guessed from his features that he was a Native American, and I suspected I knew who this was. It was obvious from his next comment that he had no idea who I was.
"Some new lady's taking over," he continued. "A real wicked witch of the West, we hear. Boss says she's going to fire me, and I expect she will. The place isn't going to last long anyways. Don't know what will happen to the town when it's gone. 6 months, tomorrow, shouldn't make a difference, but it does. I'd sort of like to leave along with my guys on the last day. We've got a goal.
A goal?
Sure do, he replied with a broad grin. We're working up to it. Our last day is going to be a record day for efficiency and productivity. When we go out that gate for the last time, we're going with our heads held high. Kinda like to be there. I knew now, without a doubt, who this stranger was, and I loved his idea of ending with your head held high. In an instant, I decided I may be going down myself, but I was going down fighting. You don't look too happy yourself, he said. I expect I'm going to be fired. You're kidding. Where do you work? That plant over there. I'm the Wicked Witch of the West. And I'll bet you're Andy Longclaw. I've heard about you. Nothing good, I might add. Andy let out a groan that began rumbling at his toes and reverberated out his head. That does it. I'm one dead Indian. I'm out of here. Not by my hand, I said. The only termination I'm considering for your department is to get rid of one very bigoted division manager who wants to fire someone who is probably the best person I've got in the plant. Andy Longclaw. Andy looked at me astonished. You putting me on? I may be the Wicked Witch of the West, but I'm no fool. So there I was, telling a total stranger everything. Somehow I knew that I could trust him, that he was someone special. Then I asked the question that would save Walton Works number 2. Tell me, that finishing department of yours seems to run like a charm in the midst of disaster. How come?
Gung-ho. We're all gung-ho.
Gung-ho? You mean excited, turned on?
Exactly. We're gung-ho.
And you're responsible for that?
Not me. My grandfather.
He works in the plant?
No way. He never even saw the inside of the plant. He's been dead for 10 years. But I became head of the finishing department 2 years before he died. And he taught me gung-ho. I taught it to the guys. Excuse me, the women, too. We've got lots of women in my department, and so we're all gung-ho.
Could we teach it to the rest of the plant?
Absolutely. Just one problem. Took me 5 years to get the finishing department gung-ho.
If you've done it once, couldn't you teach me how to do it faster the second time? Andy paused so long I thought he was ignoring me. Then he said,
3 years. Minimum 3 years.
But at best we've got 1 year, Andy, I said, almost pleading.
3 years to full gung-ho, but some change in 1 year.
Enough to save the plant?
Who knows?
Wanna try?
Beats being fired, I guess.
Sure does. Besides, being fired would look bad on your resume next to that MBA I hear you have.
Right. Good point. Gung-ho.
Gung-ho, Andy Longclaw. I'm Peggy Sinclair, and I stuck out my hand. He took it, and shaking it, said,
Gung-ho, friend.
From that time on, whenever we met or parted, the salutation was always the same. Gung-ho, friend. One thing puzzles me, I said, releasing Andy's hand.
Just one? He said with a warm laugh.
Tell me, if you've got an MBA and the ability to do what you've done in the finishing department, why have you stayed here? Seems to me you could work anywhere and in lots better jobs. When Andy gave me the answer, I was sorry I'd asked. He said his wife and son were buried in Walton. His wife had been taking their son home after school when they were hit by a drunken driver in the middle of the afternoon.
We'd planned to move along after I had a few years of hands-on management experience. But when they stayed, I did too.
I'm sorry. I didn't know what to say next, and so I sat quietly and let time fill the gap between us. Eventually I asked, "Well, if we're going to gung-ho that place," my arm waved toward the factory across the river, "how do we start?"
"Spirit of the squirrel," he replied. "It all begins with the spirit of the squirrel. Later comes way of the beaver and gift of the goose. I'm off shift at 3:30 tomorrow. Meet me at the main gate. Wear slacks. We'll be going out into the country."
It was a strange start to a productive friendship that led us eventually to the Rose Garden at the White House and an award for our gung-ho efforts. The next morning, I toured most of the factory before the midnight shift left at 8 a.m.
"Never had no general manager on the midnight shift before," said the foreman when I discovered him playing cards in the shop floor office and asked for a tour.
At 8 a.m., I had the day foreman repeat the tour. Because I'd worked the floor when I was putting myself through college, I knew the process inside out. The foremen, I could tell, were good, knowledgeable people. They just didn't much care. If the foremen were surprised to find me on the shop floor, my division managers were apoplectic. About midway through the second tour, they arrived en masse. Like a pack of sheepdogs, they started yapping at my heels, determined to herd me back to the office area. They were genuinely relieved when I suggested they all go back to the office. The only department left was the finishing department. I wanted to give that division manager a chance to redeem himself, so I suggested he come along. With my least favorite division manager at my side, I entered the finishing department. This was, he said, the prototype shop of tomorrow. Some real problems, of course, with that Andy Longclaw fellow he'd told me about.
"Won't follow orders. These people in here could be working a lot harder. I've told him to cut 3 minutes off each coffee break, but he hasn't done it. Slackers, too. Won't get rid of them."
Up on the walls, I saw gung-ho signs, and most machines had gung-ho stickers on them. "What is this gung-ho?" I asked my guide casually. He peered at the signs with some surprise, as if he had never seen them before, and I doubt he had.
"Don't know," he admitted. "Probably some subversive Indian slogan."
This really was a department like no other in the plant. It was spotlessly clean. The workers were in bright, clean uniforms, and work in progress was organized in a neat, orderly fashion. In addition to the gung-ho signs, there were all kinds of charts, graphs, and record boards reporting progress by all sorts of different measures. Most of all, I noticed the atmosphere. People were happy. The gloom in the rest of the factory was real and evident. The optimism here was every bit as real. The division manager sealed his fate when he wondered why an Indian had been hired in the first place when there were lots of honest white men available. First order of business, when I returned to my office, wasn't a pleasant one. With a generous severance package, I parted company with one of the 18 division managers I'd inherited. I believe anyone can grow and change, but I didn't have enough time to work with this person. When I met with the remaining 17, I told them two things. First, if you're going to quit, then leave. The quit but stay option is over. Looks of alarm and shock swept around the room as they realized I was dead serious. They found my second bit of news equally disquieting. I'd be leaving early that afternoon and would be out for the balance of the day chasing squirrel spirits. The division managers filed out of my office in silence. Their morning shock escalated that afternoon when I noticed 17 startled faces at office windows as I rode out the plant's main gate perched precariously on the back of Andy Longclaw's Harley Davidson. We soon left the highway and headed into the countryside. I judged we were about 15 miles from town when Andy turned into a dirt driveway and stopped in a clearing some 500 feet into the woods off the country road.
"We're here," said Andy as he shut down the Harley.
We were in the midst of a magnificent spruce forest. Close by stood a small log cabin with a wide front porch and a fieldstone chimney. The silence was beautiful. I began to walk slowly toward the cabin, letting my senses take in what was truly a magical place. Andy led me up onto the porch, got us both a cold beer, and sat me down in a large old-fashioned rocking chair. He flopped down in the hammock.
"Time to discover the spirit of the squirrel," Andy announced.
I looked at him expectantly.
"You watch the squirrels. I'm going to have a nap."
"I thought you were going to teach me about the spirit of the squirrel."
"Not exactly. You're going to learn. I'm going to have a nap. Lots of squirrels around. Tell me what you've learned when I wake up."
With that, Andy closed his eyes and was soon snoring gently. I wondered briefly if I was being had, but no. I remembered the gung-ho feeling in the finishing department. He said it began with the spirit of the squirrel. If he said to watch squirrels, then I'd watch squirrels. Andy was right about the squirrels. They were all over the place. Just off the porch was a flat plywood feeder, sitting on a stump. Squirrels came scurrying out of the woods, across the lawn, and up onto the feeder. They would then fill their cheeks with sunflower seeds and head back to the forest. I began timing the squirrels I recognized and discovered on average they were working a 3-minute, 50-second round trip. Roughly 16 trips an hour. No wonder Andy supplied the feeder automatically by chute from an overhead bin.
"Well," came Andy's voice from the hammock at the end of an hour, "what have you learned?"
"I'm not sure I've learned the spirit of the squirrel, but if people at Walton Works No. 2 worked anything like these squirrels, that factory would be booming."
"I agree," said Andy as he slowly rocked the hammock. "The question is, why do those squirrels work so hard? Find the answer to that, and you've discovered the spirit of the squirrel."
"They work hard because they're motivated," I ventured.
"Good. Excellent. And why are they motivated?"
"They have a goal. They are working toward the goal of putting away food," I said.
"And why does that goal motivate them?" asked Andy.
We both rocked while I thought. "They're motivated because if they don't store up food, they won't survive the winter. They'll die."
"Now you're beginning to understand the spirit of the squirrel."
"The point you're making, then, is there's more to the squirrel's work than just moving seed. They are motivated because the work is important."
"Their work goes beyond important. It's worthwhile," said Andy as he climbed out of the hammock and ambled into the cabin.
He returned, saying he had a gift for me. He handed me a carving of a squirrel, standing erect, mouth open, chattering. I could hear the scolding. Every hair of the squirrel's coat seemed to be detailed, and I could see the muscles ripple in its powerful hind legs.
"Andy, it's magnificent. Where did you ever get it?"
"Grandfather carved it when he taught me gung-ho. Turn it over."
I did so, and discovered, burned into the wooden base, the carver's name, Andrew Peyton, the date, July 1967, and the following: "The spirit of the squirrel, worthwhile work." There it was, the first secret that had turned the finishing department into a gung-ho team and would save Walton Works No. 2. At the time, I didn't realize just how powerful it would be.
"Your grandfather was Andrew Peyton? I saw his statue."
"Ironic, isn't it?
He carved in wood, and they did him in bronze.
It's beautiful, I said, examining the carving closely. It's a wonderful gift, Andy, but I can't accept this. Your grandfather carved it for you. Andy smiled.
True, but Gung Ho was his gift to Walton Works number 2. I have a number of his carvings. Grandfather would have wanted you to have it.
Thank you, I replied, and again looked at the message his grandfather had burned into the base. The spirit of the squirrel. Worthwhile work. Worthwhile, I said aloud as I turned the idea in my mind.
Squirrels work hard because their work is worthwhile. It works for people, too, said Andy as he again settled into his hammock. Worthwhile goes beyond important, but it starts with important.
You've said twice that worthwhile goes beyond important. How can something be more important than important?
Worthwhile doesn't mean more important than important, Andy replied with a chuckle. Worthwhile just covers more territory than important. There are 3 lessons to learn. First, the work has to be understood as important. Second, it has to lead to a well-understood and shared goal. Third, values have to guide all plans, decisions, and actions. Put all 3 together, and you've got worthwhile work. In short, spirit of the squirrel. But, as I said, it starts with important. If you want people to be gung-ho, to work with the spirit of the squirrel, they must first of all understand why they are needed. Why their work makes the world a better place. Grandfather said, the spirit of the squirrel fulfills God's plan for the forest. People have to understand how what they do contributes to the well-being of mankind, makes a difference in their own patch of forest. Most any job has social value, be it digging ditches, answering telephones, designing golf courses, or manufacturing wire baskets. Once people begin to see their work clearly, big things begin to happen. Bashing a chunk of metal and grinding it into conformity with an engineering drawing is one thing. Making a part for a brake on a child's bicycle is entirely different. Mess up the first, and you're off spec. Mess up the second, and you might break a child's leg or worse. The first is units dealt with. The second is right work. The still peace of a late summer afternoon settled over the porch as Andy began talking about how our factory served both our customers and the community. He spoke quietly, but with such insight, I soon began to see our company in a new way. I understood how our work touched people and how important it was. For the first time, I saw our product as something more than units produced. When I'd entered Andy's clearing, I'd known it was a magical place. But here was magic of a whole different order. The spirit of the squirrel is just what we need, Andy.
Gung-ho, here we come. Whoa, hold your horses, said Andy with a smile. We're not finished. Remember, worthwhile means more than important. You can't have worthwhile work unless everyone is working toward a well-understood and shared goal, Andy continued. But that's not enough. It matters how you reach the goal. You must be guided by values. You have to be proud of both the goal and how you get there. Goal setting is a big problem in most organizations. They think because they print a goal in the annual report, or announce it at some meeting, the goal is shared. They may have shared it, but if the team doesn't commit, it isn't a shared goal. Those squirrels are all committed to the same goal. In gung-ho organizations, it's the same with people.
Although we didn't discuss it that day, as we worked to gung-ho the plant, Andy taught me that I needed to have 2 types of goals. First, result goals that set out where we wanted to be, whether it was units worked on, finished or shipped, or accounts collected, or whatever. Second, value goals. Statements which set out the impact we wanted to have on the lives of our team members, our customers, our suppliers, and our community. So, worthwhile work means understanding how the work makes the world a better place. And it's also work that helps achieve a well-understood and shared goal, I said. And the third item on your list was values? Importance and goals get people going. It's values that sustain the effort. There is nothing worthwhile about work that leads to a goal arrived at by cheating. I can't tell you all the values squirrels have, but I do know they have them. For example, they value the lives of one another. If a hawk or fox comes around, they don't just save themselves. They chatter a warning to the others. To be gung-ho, you have to have values. You can compromise and negotiate on goals, Andy went on. Sometimes the fastest route to where you want to get isn't a straight line. But with values, there are only straight lines. Leaders have to insist that everyone follow the straight line. Andy paused and let this sink in before he continued. In a gung-ho organization, values are the real boss. And once you proclaim a value, you can't toss it aside just because it might be inconvenient. Values aren't set the way goals are. The minute, the second you proclaim a goal, it's real. It's set. Values don't work that way. Values become real only when you demonstrate them in the way you act and the way you insist others behave. Goals are for the future. Values are now. Goals are set. Values are lived. Goals change. Values are rocks you can count on. As I watched evening slowly slide across Andy's clearing, I thought about how different the factory would be if the spirit of the squirrel guided every team member. Okay, I promised. I'll work on this. When do I learn the way of the beaver?
First big rain, said Andy. The way of the beaver comes with the first big rain. Up here, that's usually about mid-September.
The next morning was day 3. At the end of my first day, I figured I was in big trouble. Day 2 brought hope. I wondered where day 3 would lead as I entered my office. It was early. I sat alone at my desk with poster board and crayons. I soon had a poster to hang over my desk, decorated with a very fine squirrel drawing, if I do say so myself. It read, Spirit of the Squirrel, Worthwhile Work. 1. Knowing we make the world a better place. 2. Everyone works toward a shared goal. 3. Values guide all plans, decisions, and actions. My division managers had departed en masse yesterday, and this morning they arrived en masse. I sent word I'd meet with them in 10 minutes. From the cafeteria, I ordered coffee. Brew it strong, I told the cook. I needed these people alert. When they were settled in, I began talking about the difference our products made to customers. As I talked, I sensed small scratches of pride were opening up. Nothing major, mind you. But eyes remained open. My ending also caught their attention. I like to think I know what this company is all about. However, I'd like to hear what you think. I want you to get your thoughts organized on 3 issues. Why are we here? What are our goals? What values will guide us? We'll meet back here tomorrow morning. I look forward to hearing your ideas. At the suggestion that they contribute their own thoughts, looks ranging from acute heartburn to panic swept through the room. Frankly, I enjoyed watching them squirm. Had I known how quickly I'd be squirming myself, I would have felt more compassion. The call came at noon. Old Man Morris was on the line, and he wasn't happy. The figures for Walton Works No. 2 didn't look good. What was I going to do about it? The plant would have to be closed if I didn't shape up. I didn't miss the message. It was I who had to shape up. I'd been on the job 2.5 days, and I owned the problem. How long have I got?
I expect results by Christmas. That's 4 months. I think that's more than reasonable.
I swear I could hear Old Man Morris chuckling long after I'd hung up. I shuffled out to Andy's motorcycle at shift change and gave him the news.
4 months, he said. That brings us to year end. I can probably get us until next August. That's a year. We'll just have to do it in a year.
How can you get us until August? I questioned. My voice clearly said, just who do you think you are? But Andy didn't take offense. He only smiled and said,
I've got an idea. Trust me.
It's not as if I had anything to lose, I replied, and tried to give him a smile in return. Gung-ho, friend?
Gung-ho, friend, he said, giving me the thumbs-up sign.
Friday morning, I took my post at the head of the table as my division managers filed in. Initial statements were evasive and brief. I was at my gentle, patient best, and eventually, with effort, some true feelings and ideas began to emerge. A little genuine pride did exist, but it was obvious it would be a while before people wore their hearts on their sleeves. There was minimal interest in setting goals for growth, which would require a stretch and a real challenge. Discussing values aroused only mild interest. I announced that starting Monday, we would begin meeting every day after lunch for 1 hour to discuss 3 issues. Why we were here, what we thought our long-term and short-term goals should be, and what values we'd honor. I had little doubt about a couple of goals and values I'd insist on, but I wanted to see what they came up with first. Saturday, Andy showed up at my office door at noon.
Figured you might be here. Can't spend the whole weekend in the office. Want to spend the afternoon at the cabin?
And so began a tradition. Saturday afternoon at the cabin. That day, we reviewed where we were and set out plans for the week ahead. On Wednesday, we'd push the process down one level, from division managers to the department heads. That would involve another 50 people. The next week, we'd involve the lead hands, a further 200. I asked Andy why his grandfather had used the term gung-ho. It just didn't seem to fit with squirrels, beavers, and geese.
It doesn't, agreed Andy. But it fit Grandfather. He served in World War I, and his speech was peppered with military phrases and words. He told me gung-ho was Chinese for working together, and the slogan of Carlson's Raiders during the Second World War.
Carlson's Raiders, Andy explained, were the men in the 2nd Marine Raider Division who were known for their enthusiasm, teamwork, and outstanding results. When I tried to find out more about the Way of the Beaver, Andy put on his stoic Indian face and intoned,
Way of Beaver come with first big rain.
I decided it was his way of telling me I had more than enough to keep me busy. And he was right. The next few days were full, frantic, and sometimes fun. I also had times of panic and nights of worry. I couldn't pass a playground without looking at the children and realizing that their fathers and mothers worked at the plant. To combat the paralyzing effects of worry, I toured the plant every morning and then crossed over to the building which contained the finishing department. There it was, a gung-ho jewel, my talisman that it could be done, if only I had the talent to pull it off. If only I had the time. In the afternoon, I went from department to department in the main plant, dragging a division manager, meeting with workers, and trying, at Andy's suggestion, to call them team members. My job in these meetings was to point out why Walton Works No. 2 made the world a better place. They didn't buy it all the first time, but they listened, and I opened every meeting repeating the same message. Once they understood I really wanted to talk about goals to be set jointly, not ones imposed by me or by division managers or head office, they began to open up. The cork had been in the bottle so long that once loosened, it popped. but like the division managers, their focus wasn't on what they might do. Rather, it was on what they wanted the company to do. It would take a while before they began to see themselves and the company as one and the same entity. The following Saturday, Andy made a great show of examining the sky before we left for what had become our regular weekend outing to the cabin. Then, taking a leaf, he crumbled it in his hand and threw the pieces up in the air where the breeze carried them a short distance. Andy watched the crumbled bits hit the ground, and after a short but very official-sounding chant, he announced,
"Heavy rainstorm come, way of the beaver tomorrow."
The twinkle in his eye and his exaggerated parody of Saturday matinee Indian speak should have alerted me, but I walked right into it. "You can tell a storm is coming from that clear sky and crumpled leaves?"
"That plus magic box weather spirit," asserted Andy.
"Powerful medicine. Willard Scott, TV2, 7 a.m. Followed by Sandy, local weather lady. Very reliable. Powerful medicine. As for the leaves, great show for tourists and gullible bosses."
The magic box forecasters were indeed powerful medicine. The rain began at 3 p.m., and for 6 hours, sheets of water poured down. The river beside the plant turned from a placid, slow-moving mass into a turbulent and tumbling torrent. Apparently, rains like this came every September. It was time for me to learn the way of the beaver. Taking a path through the woods behind the cabin, we soon came to an old abandoned logging road, which we followed for about a mile. Then we turned right, down another path, which led to the edge of a pond, circled by a narrow trail. The rain had filled the pond beyond capacity. Trees were standing in the water. In several spots, the trail was washed out. On the far side, we came upon a large tree in which, 10 feet up, I could see several boards anchored between two substantial branches and the trunk. A homemade ladder gave access.
"Here we are," said Andy. "Up we go."
We had a perfect perch to see a beaver dam, damaged by the heavy rain. Water was spilling out over a 15-foot section, which had lost its top 2 feet of twigs, trees, and mud. New tree branches were already anchored in the old base. We sat down cross-legged, and Andy handed me binoculars.
"Normally, beaver do dam maintenance at night, but this break is major. They'll be working on it in daylight. That's their lodge over there."
"You mean that pile of sticks?"
"That's it. The entrance is underwater. The floor inside is above water level, but the water protects the doorway. Even if we began ripping away at the outside, they could slip out underwater and get away. It's critical they control the water level."
"Spirit of the squirrel," I observed.
"Exactly. But this is a more complex society and community than squirrels. There's a lot more going on here, and more to learn."
We sat quietly and waited. After a while, a brown head, fur slick with water, broke the surface. A telltale ripple angled out behind as the beaver started to move. 3 other heads popped up. Andy spoke quietly.
"The spirit of the squirrel leads to gung-ho only when it is matched with way of the beaver."
It was easy to see why the phrase, "busy as a beaver," was part of our language. Like the squirrels, they seemed tireless. Luckily, the high water put many trees within easy reach. These they cut down with their teeth, a noisy process, I discovered, and then dragged them through the water to the repair site. Holding a branch in their teeth, they dove down or pulled a tree trunk up, looking for a place to anchor it. Once or twice, the current washed a hard-won branch over the dam. It was an inconvenience the beavers had learned to deal with. They headed right back for another. I watched, fascinated by the drive and energy which sustained them. Again, Andy spoke quietly.
"The way of the beaver answers the question, who is in charge here?"
A boss beaver? It wasn't readily apparent which beaver was senior. After half an hour, I was no wiser. Exactly what pattern was being followed was a mystery. I'm sorry, Andy, I can't tell. It doesn't look like anyone's in charge, I said softly.
And if no one's in charge, who tells each beaver what to do next and how to do it?
Prompted Andy.
I guess they tell themselves, I ventured.
You've got it!
Andy exclaimed with such enthusiasm that a loud warning crack of a beaver's tail whacking the water rang out, and four beavers plunged below the surface.
Oops, got carried away, said Andy in a normal voice. But that's okay. They'll be down for a couple of minutes. Give us a chance to talk instead of whisper.
The way of the beaver is being your own boss? I questioned Andy. By way of answering, Andy reached in his backpack and withdrew a carving I recognized immediately. It was an Andrew Peyton beaver. Propped up by the tail, the beaver stood on hind legs, a stick between its teeth held in place by front paws. Again, the detail was superb. I turned it over and read the second secret. The way of the beaver. In control of achieving the goal. Andy said, each beaver has a large measure of control over its own destiny. They decide how the work is going to be done. They operate like independent contractors. There it was, the way of the beaver. If I had any question as to exactly what it meant, Andy quickly set me straight. If everybody has the spirit of the squirrel, but management makes the workers do everything by management's book, that organization won't be